Victoria here with a little housekeeping. Today's episode is the last of this season, and thank you for listening. We're going to take an extended break, but we'll be back in April. I have a book due in May that I hope will be done by then, and then two more books in the works after that. So we are going to move to monthly episodes rather than weekly. I've loved talking to so many people, but the pace is just unsustainable with so much writing to do. With the slower pace, we are changing up the format a bit. The episodes will be more like the holiday specials, with an author coming on to talk about a witchlit classic in context of their work. None of those episodes are recorded yet, so I can't offer spoilers, but we will post a quick update so you'll know what we're discussing if you'd like to read it first. One other quick thing, I've moved my personal and podcast accounts off Meta. If you'd still like to follow us on social media, you can find me on Blue Sky at Witchtoria. That is VVITCHTORIA. And the podcast is at Witchlit Pod, the same as we were on other social media. I also post Witchlit stuff to my Mastodon account. It's that same Witchtoria at mastodon.social. I hope to see you on Blue Sky or Mastodon for more book giveaways, etc. And you'll hear from us with the next iteration of Witchlit in April. Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witchlit is brought to you by Thousand Volt Press, a family-owned independent publisher established to produce the books we want to see in the world. All our titles can be purchased directly from thousandvoltpress.com or wherever you buy books. If you'd like to support Witchlit, please consider buying us a coffee at ko-fi.com/witchlitpodcast. Melissa Madera is a witch, herbalist, educator, and author living in New York City. They're the head of Moon Cult, an online organization dedicated to sharing quality education and resources on witchcraft, occult, history, and the botanical arts. Melissa's research centers on the folklore and pre-Christian religions, with a particular focus on finding historical formularies for food, fragrance, and herbcraft. Find their features in the New York Times, Vogue, Vice, or follow Melissa's published works in Fillers Green, Benefica magazine, and their debut book, The Witch's Feast. Their latest book, The Witch's Workshop, is out now. Melissa Madera, welcome to Witchlit.
Thank you so much. It's so good to be here.
I should say welcome back to Witchlit.
Oh, yeah, I know. It's been so long. When was our first episode?
It's been almost 2 years, I think.
Goodness, how time flies.
I know, it's crazy. We're like quickly approaching 160 episodes.
Congratulations. That's huge.
Yeah.
When did your podcast launch?
January of 2022.
Wow. Fresh out of the pandemic. There we go.
Yeah.
Wow. So,
well, cool.
Happy to be back.
Yeah. I'm happy to have you back. So, you know, our first question for everybody is why write? And you answered that last time. So, I guess I will make it more specific. And so why The Witch's Workshop? Why this book?
So the first book that I wrote, and we talked about this last time, really came out of like frustration with the fact that that information that I was writing about in The Witch's Feast was just so not available in an accessible way to anyone in like the witch book market. The second book came from kind of a different impetus. This is really more about my poetic relationship with the land, with plants, with crafting as a magical process and a magical practice. Mm-hmm. And so this is a really bit more authentic to like my personal work. And the research for it was naturally super fun as a result, because I'm very, very passionate about, you know, all the different processes that are in the book. If your readers haven't heard of it before, The Witch's Workshop really takes you through core crafts of the magical art. So like making your own oils, incense, candles, and just other things you might be using, you know, as tools as an occultist, and presents you with a number of different historical perspectives on how they've been created and how they've been used, and then walks you through, you know, 10 to 15 recipes per chapter that show you a lot of different facets of like how these materia can be employed in the magical art and how they've been employed historically. So very, very different from the first book, but still centered around empowering the reader to really take up these tools for themselves. Instead of, you know, going to a shop and relying on quote unquote professionals to make things for you and to outsource that kind of work, to really instead focus on how can I become a practitioner that develops these relationships with plants, with materia, with minerals, and with the environment that I'm on for myself? And what does that process do for my practice?
And I think that was what you touched on there. For me, it was one of the things I enjoyed most about the book, is it really is, yes, support your apothecaries, but you don't have to do all that. You can do a lot of this yourself. Like, it's not, yes, it's not rocket science. It's just having the formula.
Yeah. And also like developing that relationship, like I said, with like, not just, I don't know. One of the things I really wanted to drive home in the work was like the animistic perspective behind crafting arts in the occult sphere. That we're not doing these things as like, I reach for a leaf, which is an object, and I'm combining it with an oil that is an object, but instead to see these things as very spiritually and energetically alive and have that be a relationship that we cultivate as part of our practice. But you touched on something that I think about quite a bit, and maybe you have some perspective on this too. Why are people so afraid to make this stuff for themselves? I feel like people are so much more likely to rely upon a professional, like an Instagram brand or something like that, to make oils that we view as high quality, or, you know, to make products that we view as having these inherent magical qualities. But I don't see a lot of people doing that work for themselves at home. Why do you think people are so like much more inclined to not pick it up?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think part of it is that everybody assumes that someone is so much further ahead than they are on their journey, that, you know, this is, I'm going to turn to this person who's has more expertise than I do to do it. When I, to me, like, I think a lot of the magic is just getting your hands dirty, you know, and 100%. I think that's probably maybe intimidating. I don't know. And I think, you know, a lot of people, you know, it's funny because it kind of comes back to your first book too. I think, you know, we don't teach people how to cook anymore. It's not always part of home. And you're, I think, right, this is that same kind of thing, that not taking those things into your own hands. It's like, it's really,
why would I make it when I can buy it?
Yeah.
You know, but what you miss out in not making it is like, there's traditional skills that are being completely lost that I hope that the Witch's Workshop like helps bring back into production, teaching people how to dye things themselves, teaching people how to make their own candles from like the stuff you can find in the woods, you know, things like that. And you're right. We are really, there's been this movement to like commodify witchcraft in the last 10 years, where everything's a product that is for sale. And I wanted to kind of like slow people down with this book, slow them down, put them back in touch to with the dirt. You know what I mean? Like, grab them by the hair, put their face to the earth and say, say, don't be afraid of it. And don't be so intimidated by the process that you lose out on this sort of like depth and richness that it can bring to a green witchcraft practice. So that's what I hope is translated.
I do wonder if there's like an access issue. Like, I think some people think, I don't have access to these things because I live in the city. And I'm like, you live in New York City and you you do this.
First of all, you can get anything here. New York City, you can get a whale's pancreas if you want to. Like,
I think that might be illegal, but we're not encouraging you to go get a whale's pancreas, but you could if you wanted to.
Yeah. But also, this city, like every single block in New York City, there's mugwort cracking up through the sidewalk. You know what I mean? I encounter this idea a lot with people talking about green witchcraft perspectives in urban environments. People really like labor under this delusion that there are no plants here, or that if there are plants, there's no wilderness here. And I'm like, the wilderness is the principle of reality that we can never escape. Human civilization and domestication is really sort of this dream that we're all having that like preserves us against the chaos of nature. But that wilderness is right there beneath the surface at all times. And witchcraft is about prying up that concrete and getting to that wild thing underneath. So who's served really when I circumvent that process and just go to the shop and spend $20 on an oil that I don't know what it's made with? I don't know if it's made with integrity. I don't know if the person who's making it is being authentic in the production. You know what I mean? Who's served by that transaction? Not me as the practitioner. So that was the impetus for the book. That's why I write The Witch's Workshop.
And I think it's a good impetus, and I hope people will pick it up and use it. I've given it as gifts already, so hopefully.
Thank you. Have you made anything from the book?
I have. I've made some incense and I've made some oils. I have saved a bunch of avocados to dye, but I haven't done that yet. So
avocado dye is such a pretty like rosy pink. Mm-hmm. I ended up falling in love with it through the book. And I had not done like that many natural dye projects before mm-hmm. the book. That was one of the ones that I fell in love with almost immediately. Yeah. So happy you're giving it a shot.
Yeah, that's no, great. And it actually has dovetailed with a lot of my research. So I've also cited your book.
And you're kidding.
Yeah, no, not at all. I'm not kidding at all. So, yeah.
Wow.
I was like super excited to have you back on to talk about this one because I was like, oh, I mean, not that we didn't geek out together about food, but I was like, oh, this is like where my brain is right now too. So.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
You know, another thing that the book does that I think is real cool that you can't find other places is like put people in touch with actual historical material. Like mm-hmm. we have, I think, these ideas about like what magical materia is used for and what its history is like. But when you're actually in touch with like the authentic practices, A, you're getting a much deeper understanding of like these substances outside of the modern context. Mm-hmm. And you're also getting a lot of information about like their use throughout history. Like one of the things that really shocked me in the writing of the book was learning that candle magic, as we think of it now in the modern world with like carving and brassing and the glitter and all that stuff, is like less than 200 years old. Mm-hmm. And that like throughout history, no one's using colored candles because those are invented and mass produced in the 1800s. And so when we look for like the history of the candle as an occult object, that kind of ends like 200 years ago.
Yeah.
And I was legitimately shocked by that. I was expecting to find references to like blessed candles in the Solomonic grimoires. I was at least expecting to find some of that, you know, in medieval folk magic, but there really, really isn't. And so that kind of made me reassess my relationship with the materia and be like, okay, why use this object? What functionally mm-hmm. does it do? And like, why is it something that we use in the modern world now? You can find analogous charms from ancient history for like lamps and stuff. And you will still see those in like kudu and root work and other right. traditions that still work with the antiquated technologies like that. But it made me just really reconsider like the role of this object in my practice, where normally I think most people take it for granted as like, of course, a witch comes with candles. You know what I mean? Part mm-hmm. of the job. For the bulk of human history has not been true.
Yeah. I mean, they were there, but they were so they could see what they were doing.
Exactly. Yeah. when we find historical references for them, it's like witches work with candles because witches work at night mm-hmm. and to do clandestine rites that no one is seeing out in the nighttime. That's why you need a candle, not a special consecrated one, not a blessed taper. You know who was using blessed tapers throughout history? Christians. Mm-hmm. Not the witches. They would go one of the special Virgin Mary holidays. I forget what it was, but during like the witch trials era, they'd go and specifically have candles blessed against the witches in your community. That was the reference I could find for like sacred candles historically. Yeah. It was just so funny to have it come from, you know, the other team.
Yeah. I mean, well, and I think I've heard Jesse Diaz Hathaway talk about you know, sometimes when people are talking about the old religion, they're really talking about Catholicism.
Yeah, so true. Oh my God.
I think, did I say his name backwards? I think I may have said his name backwards.
I think it's Jesse Hathaway Diaz. He's also a New Yorker. Great yeah. guy. He and I are going to be speaking at a conference together this summer. We're both lecturing on occult herbalism at the Veritas Genii Symposium.
Oh,
it's my first time speaking there. I've heard him speak there before when I've attended the conference. Corinne Boyer is going to be there too.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah, great roundup of folks. I'm really excited. I'm actually turning in my paper for them later this week. So very excited.
Yeah, I haven't been able to go, but I get the paper, the books.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm writing my article for that book for next year. I'm doing a whole article on adversarial animism. So thinking about animism through the lens of historical spells and charms in which the practitioner is not friendly to the plant spirit. Instead, like, tortures the plant spirit and like threatens them, says, if you don't do what I want you to do, if this spell doesn't work, I'm going to come back here mm-hmm. and rip you up and, you know, all that stuff. So it's interesting because these spells like that present an animist perspective in which we're seeking relationship with the spirits of the land and we know that we need them to make medicine, mm-hmm. to make magic and stuff like that. But instead of forming connection and like venerating them, we turn on them. Mm-hmm. And it's just so like antithetical to the animism that I practice that I was like, I have to do a paper on this.
Yeah.
So that's what I'll be talking about.
Well, and it sounds that much like goetic magic or something too. Like it sounds like demon threatening or saint bothering or something.
I bring that up in the article. I think we look at from the Lesser Key of Solomon, like some of the language around this ritual called the Spirit's Chain. Everyone's probably heard of that before, gone through the text, but it's like when the demon you're summoning doesn't do what you want them to do, you summon them and you trap them in a box and you like bang on the box while cursing them with all the sacred names. And then you use your ceremonial sword to suspend that box over the fire and like cook it. And I was like, this is nuts. And we see similar techniques, right? We see similar techniques in like agricultural plant magic to make your plants fruit. You go out in the field and you curse them and you whip them. Which I thought was so crazy. So that's the kind of work that I'm presenting at VGS. I haven't seen anyone else talk about this weird subset of plant charms. And I feel like a conference on occult herbalism where most people are operating from an animist perspective is going to find this super, super interesting.
What is it? There's a book that came out a few years ago, Cursing the Basil. And she talks about a lot of these same kind of thing, like these weird plant charms. Like when you planted basil, you had to curse it or it wouldn't grow.
Who wrote that book? I need to know.
I will send you a link. I'll have to look it up.
Okay. So, I'm going to write this down. Thank you so much. Because there aren't that many of these charms. And when I was writing the paper, I was like, ooh, I've backed myself into a very narrow corner here.
Yeah.
I think overwhelmingly, like the folklore of like European plant magic is very worshipful of the plant kingdom, very, very honoring of the work that they do and understanding that like we really credit the plants for our survival. And so.
Rightly so. Yeah,
absolutely. So it's even weirder that we find a few of these charms existing. That's what I'm working on right now. That's my current research.
Cool. So we talked about this. I mean, listeners know that I always talk to the guests beforehand. But we talked about kind of your post being a store owner, being a cult shop owner life. So like, has that opened up more time for you? And how have you put that back into your work? I guess having that different kind of perspective and time.
Yeah, we did talk about this a little bit before we get started, but last year was my first year without Catland. Sad times, sad to see it go, lots of grief in leaving the store behind. And things have been fine for me. I mostly just teach and write. You know, I've spent a lot more time with the cats, which is great. But the thing that I really found myself missing at the end of this year was the community that gathers around education. I miss being in touch with nerds on a daily basis. I really, truly miss people coming into the shop with interesting questions and then both of us getting to hunt for the perfect resource. I was saying this before we got started, but I took a trip for work out to Portland this last October and I got to meet the folks at Dark Star Magic out there. Great people. I wandered in actually because there was a poster on the front of the shop that mentioned my colleague Eric Arneson, who runs the Arnomancy podcast. And I was like, fucking Arnie works here? So walked in, met with them and got to just see the fresh crop of beautiful new occult titles from like great, excellent publishers. They have a good rare book selection. And to talk to them about that, to be among the book people again, I was like, this is what I need in the rest of my career. So there has been a little bit of a pivot in my brand in the last 6 months. I'm kind of moving away from a lot of my like crafting for work, doing away with my oils for sale, my incense for sale, and instead focusing a lot more on small press and like supporting independent researchers. So some of the publishers I'm really excited about right now are the zines from Fiddler's Green or Wonderella Press. Leo Droon Press, I've fallen in love with their little chapbooks. Same thing with Halder, which mostly presents research on like Germanic magic and like ancient Germanic magic. They've got a great zine out, not really a zine, it's like a little perfect bound book on Elder Tree folklore that I think is really interesting. They also have a sick one on the Anglo-Saxon Nine Herbs charm. So just like really jazzed about kind of this movement we're seeing in occult books publishing that's geared towards small print zine-like books and things that are easier for smaller imprints to produce in terms of like printing costs and all of that and can really help support like more bite-sized academia from, you know, the researchers that they're supporting, which I think, I don't know, in this modern era where we're consuming bite-sized content on a regular basis. I think it's perfect for the market. I think it's also a really interesting way to be presenting what I've been calling like unofficial academic research or presenting like interesting papers and and research content outside of like a very gatekept academic context.
Yeah.
It really feels like that information is being liberated for a public audience through this small movement that we're seeing. And so that's where I'm going in the future of Moon Cult, is really focusing on the books, the education, and being among the nerds again.
Yeah, I feel like that is my place among the nerds.
If someone's not hype about like 11th century plant charms, like what do I have to say to you at a meeting? You know what I mean?
It's interesting. I'm thinking about like Darkstar and their rare book section. And I think, you know, kind of going back to that idea of access, I think, you know, at least when I came to the occult, like in the early 90s, like the books that were available were largely from Weiser and Llewellyn and not, you know, if they did reference older books, it was in the bibliography. If it was there, there was even a bibliography. So you didn't really know where this stuff came from.
Yeah.
And so now I feel like, you know, we have access and, you know, bless the Internet Archive. You have access to like scanned copies of any book you could want in almost any language that were never available to people outside of academia who could travel to the libraries where those books actually existed.
100%. And I feel like since the 90s, you know, we have this new witch wave in like the 2010s, 2016, around the first time Trump was elected. We had this big occult movement. And I think that one of the things that this movement did that the ones of the 90s and the 70s kind of failed to do is making occultism accessible and really making getting into the subject and researching it something that a normal person could do and to be able to put normal people in touch with like authentic historical information. It's something that I just haven't seen in the books of the 70s and 90s so much. I'm grateful for it. We have a lot of like really good publishers like Scarlet Imprint, Three Hands Press, Troy Books that are all doing that kind of work. And that making that information accessible is something I'm so passionate about in my work. It's why I do so much like historical digging and showing people like where these traditions come from, because I know it's nearly impossible to dig that information out yourself, especially if you're just coming to this information for the first time.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty intimidating to go look at even scanned copies of like, you know, 17th century books. If you aren't familiar with the language or or you can't read black letter or, you know, any of those things, like it's still difficult, but it's available. And so I think you're right. I think having someone, you know, saying this is where this information is and this is my parse for you.
Yes.
You know, but you can go look at it yourself. Yep. But here's like, here's, you know, kind of an intro to it.
So. That's everything I do. That's what we do at Moon Cult, really, is I'm in the grimoires losing my mind. And then I come back with an article that explains a magical technique for everyone. And I spare them the experience of going insane in the subnotes, but that's where I make my home. I love to go insane in a footnote.
I was gonna say, the research I'm doing right now, I've had multiple conversations like, you know, like I look at this and I'm like, I want to reference this, but clearly they're referencing somebody else. So let me go look. And then, you know, 8 layers later, I realized that's not what they actually said. It's been transmuted over time.
Oh my God. Yeah.
The book that they're quoting isn't the book that it's actually from. It's from a different book.
There's a lot of that in this industry. I think
it's everywhere.
Oh, but 100%.
Yeah.
A lot in this industry, though. I find a lot of the publishers take a very relaxed approach to verifying citation? Information. Yeah, citation, verifying information, very relaxed. Even my publishers, I love them, but I'm like, you don't need me to provide a little backup for this information. And they're like, nah, we trust you as a professional. And I'm very relaxed by that, but I know it's not good for the academic rigor of the work. It's something that's not possible to do with the bigger publishers, you know, for the kind of books that they turn out. But it is something that I've been seeing more of in like the last 10 years of occult book publishing. It gets me hype. I'm really pumped to be sharing more of that kind of information in an accessible way that's accessible for readers and accessible for access, as in like it's able to be hacked through by someone who doesn't have a college education, and it's not hard to get to.
I think that the other part of making it accessible, I think that because people are talking about it, is this idea. It's like, if you look at some of the stuff in the PGM and in the Picatrix, like A, you're probably not going to be able to get those things. Like, mm-hmm. they're either illegal or they're extinct or,
oh yeah,
you know, and if you could get them, some of them you probably don't want to ingest or, you know, what, you know, they're poisonous. It's actual shit, you know, like all these kinds of things. Yeah. It's like, yes. So you're looking at this in context of when this magic was done. How do you bring that into your contemporary context and go, how do I make this work without poisoning myself or getting arrested?
Oh, I talk about that all the time, especially with Eric Arneson, who I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. We talked about that a lot on his podcast, where we talked about updating ancient magic for a modern practicing experience. Mm-hmm. And what is more important? Is it more important for us to be focusing on getting the rituals right and recreating an ancient experience, which is in a lot of ways not possible? These papyrus documents have holes in them. Like, yeah. We simply do not know. And we don't have all the cultural context for all of this stuff. Is that more important, or is it more important to be creating what I call right experience, where mm-hmm. it's like, okay, you know, this recipe from 200 AD wants me to use an untold amount of pig's blood, right? I am now going to, as a modern occultist, look at the text and say, why are we using this ingredient? What is its role within the larger operation? And how can I make a meaningful substitution that is accessible for me in the mm-hmm. modern world? There's so much of that negotiation that comes when you're working with the older texts, because in a lot of ways, we can't ever recreate what they had.
No.
And also the texts, as we inherit them now, lack the layers of like context, metaphor, and interpretation with which they were originally understood. And so just taking them at face value mm-hmm. sometimes completely misses the point. Especially in the PGM, you mentioned this a second ago, you know a lot, I'm sure, about the herbal codes that they use, where it'll say, you know, use the wings of a bat or whatever, mm-hmm. and they'll be referring to holly leaves. It's sort of like an herbal code such that people who weren't part of the magician's core group wouldn't be able to read these texts. So it's a fence, in a sense.
Right.
My favorite, like, occult fact is that when the knowledge to read ancient Greek language was lost in the medieval period, and then slowly regained, they re-encountered these texts again for the first time and didn't have that cultural context. And so mm-hmm. only were able to read them literally. And that's where traditions like Shakespearean versions of witchcraft, where there are, you know, witches in Macbeth stirring the cauldron with eye of newt and toe of frog, it comes from this translation error that exists yeah. only because we forgot the ancient Greek language
yeah.
And because this text exists in this funny way. And that just shows me that, like, we're not even able to read these books with the same eyes that people of the mm-hmm. ancient world were. So it's always going to require that level of interpretation and reimagining.
Yeah.
Haitian Press has a couple of good zines on that subject that mm-hmm. people should check out if they're interested in that. They've got a bunch of zines called The Guides to the Underworld, and they've got mm-hmm. one about, like, Agrippa's planetary incenses, which are from the 1500s and involve, like, muddled cow eyeballs and stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, they're like, how do we take these recipes and make them not disgusting?
Yeah. And maybe don't burn sulfur in your house. Maybe that's not a good idea.
Yeah, no, not a thing we're doing in 2025.
Yeah. No, I appreciate those. They're great. And, well, it just, you know, I think if... It's funny to me because I know we have similar interests over, like, the, like, food things too. It's like mm-hmm. when you look at recipes from ancient Rome, or you even look at, you know, medieval recipe books, there's so much assumed that you know yes. how to do. And uh-huh. I always assume that that's true of magical texts too, because
100%.
They're just like, make it and do this. And you're like, okay, well, that assumes that I know what make it means, or, you know, what you're saying mm-hmm. in this context means. And that's true in cookbooks all the way up until, like, Mrs. Beaton.
Absolutely. 100%. It's funny you should bring up food in this context, because there's one example that always exists in my mind of people who use food in the occult to try to recreate a historical experience. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean this to cast shade on anyone. It's something I've noticed. That within neo-pagan communities, which draw a lot of their inspiration from, like, medieval European magic traditions, when we talk about, like, the kinds of feasts that are served at those events, or the kind of food which is considered magical, what's published in a lot of the neo-pagan cookbooks, it's a lot of medieval food.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because that's the era that's inspiring a lot of the magic. Unfortunately, medieval food is not good.
well, especially made... by with all this extrapolation. I mean, I think there probably were medieval dishes that were delicious, but we don't really know how they did all of that.
No, all we have is like to use beer as a leavener and just fill everything with untold amounts of nutmeg and like dried fruit. I'm so sick of nutmeg and dried fruit. When I show up to a neo-pagan gathering and there's a dish with nutmeg and dried fruit, I'm out. I'm done. When I was doing the research for the first book, I went through so many like Wiccan neo-pagan kitchen witchcraft books, and the techniques were good, right? Mm-hmm. The like knowledge of how and why we use ingredients was good, but a lot of the recipes were so medieval inspired. I was like, what are we doing? Yeah. Just funny that it shook out that way. But that's my favorite example of like, are we recreating a historic experience or are we reinterpreting it for the modern?
Yeah. No one needs to eat a whole nutmeg. Nobody needs to do that. I don't even think, I mean, there's what it's supposed to be hallucinogenic. I was like, that's not the kind of trip you want to have.
So. Oh my God, no. Yeah, there's a lot of that stuff historically. I mean, poisoning yourself a lot more common in older time periods, centuries and centuries ago.
Well, or, you know, like in Rome, like you want to have a Roman experience, add some lead to your wine to make it sweeter.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Like there are things that we don't need to be doing.
Oh my God. So true. So true. Yeah. Yeah. It's like the raw milk thing, you know, but with occultism. It's people, we've had pasteurization for so long, but now there's this romanticizing of unpasteurized experiences. You get within 15 feet of a cow, you understand the problem that pasteurization is meant to fix, right?
Yeah.
But we're so far away from that that we've lost the context for it. And I feel like when we look at these older spells, we lose the context that like they lived in a world that was also much more comfortable with like animal violence. You could conceivably leave your house and go find a dead man's hand. Like, that was a thing a normal person could do.
Right.
We don't operate within the same world. So, of course, the magical rules have to change.
Yeah. Well, and I also think, like, one of the things I think about contextually, especially in a lot of the stuff I've read recently, like, so much of it was community oriented. Mm-hmm. Like, because that was still, you know, there was still many gods worshipped, and you and your neighbor might go to the temple together and do things. And I was like, we just don't have, like, talk about a context we don't have. Like, that's huge.
Not in the occult world, for sure. I mean, we definitely have that within, like, the wider world of religion. I feel like for a lot of, like, rural communities, that is the community experience, is centered around your religion and your faith and all of that. But I regret that we don't really have it in the occult world as much as I would like to see. I've seen lots of attempts to like get it started in different ways. Little covens spring up and then they become public. And then, you know, there becomes like an open ritual experience and a community grows up. But like everything, you know, the torch eventually gets passed or things get put down. And I've never really seen one of those movements take root in the way that I wanted it to. That's also why community building is such a huge part of what I do at Moon Cult. And we've got a lot of members from like all over the world. We've got people from Japan. We've got people from California, Alaska, you know, and it's digital, but we have a Discord group where we have basically like a witches group chat. Everyone gets to talk about their research. We've also been like, we've grown to care about each other. We do legitimately become a little bit of a community. A couple of our members were affected by the West Coast wildfires recently. And so we were able to like check on each other and provide resources if they were needed. So I don't know whether we were doing this at Catland or I'm doing this on my independent platform. I feel like the two like passions of mine that really always guide the work is making occult information accessible and gearing it around community growth and empowering the practitioner. That's such an important part of what I do. So it's great that you should bring that up. Have you seen like sustainable occult community? Anywhere.
I mean, I know that there are
online,
mostly online. I know that there are like I'm in the Bay Area and I know that there are some long lived covens in the area that have been around for a long time. I'm personally currently not part of any of those. But but yeah, I mean, I think because we are so spread out and really, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, there's still not very many of us, even though it's definitely building in context. It's not, you know, there might be more pagans than Presbyterians, but they're not more than there are Christians in general.
Oh, true.
So But I do think that community aspect that happens online, and I know people shit on that, but I'm like, you know, it's huge. Like you said, I mean, we check on each other, we get to know each other. It's like a whole different, and especially as social media kind of implodes and people move to these smaller digital communities, I think those communities get tighter too.
They do. They really do. It is a shame that there's no like wider occult community that I can direct people to. But in a way, that's kind of a good thing. Mm-hmm. I feel like communities shine. They really shine when they're small enough for everyone to be so invested. You know what I mean? When it becomes a project that everyone cares about instead of just something that a few people at the top of a hierarchy steward and pour their energy into. Yeah. I feel like that's why a lot of the larger communities fail, is because that role is really, really draining and really, really thankless.
Yeah. And we don't have the infrastructure that like Christian clergy has. Like there's not a parsonage, you know, like that kind of stuff hasn't happened. And I don't know that it will ever, because we'd work differently. So.
Especially not in America. I still feel like there's a very, I still feel like this is a very Christian nation. And I still feel like there's a lot of anti-pagan sentiment. I don't know if it's specifically anti-pagan or just anti everything that's not Christian America. But I don't, even just running Catland, we were so within the public eye and caught a lot of the vitriol of people like that. I simply don't know if like a public occult community would do well in this kind of climate. You know what I mean? I see it do well in places like England. I see it do well in places like Germany. I just don't know that America's ready for the satanic church to erect a building.
I mean, they kind of have one in Salem and people try to set on fire.
Constantly. Yes.
Oh. Yeah. I mean, it does surprise me in New York that you got pushback. But then again, it doesn't surprise me either. New York is a multitude.
I mean, they bust people up from North Carolina to come pick at us. Yeah, they especially I really saw a big shift under the Republican presidencies, that's where we saw a lot of people really activated to come shut us down. And they felt like they had a real divine purpose for doing that. And it wasn't something that I saw, I think, before the pandemic or, you know, in other, I feel like there was a big social shift that happened that really emboldened rage against or like militarized the Christian American. Yeah. Right. I'm trying not to make this political, but it kind of is.
No, I mean, it kind of is political. And I mean, well, you know, everything's political on some level, but.
Really? Oh, can I say fuck on your podcast? I forgot.
Yes, you can. Oh, cool. We have an explicit because I figured, again, it's about witchcraft and the occult, and people would get their panties in a bunch. So I made it explicit so nobody could complain. So.
I love that. I love that. But so, yeah, there you are, kind of anticipating that there's going to be that sort of, you know, pushback. It's annoying, but I feel like it's a part of the culture. I feel like here's something that I think, and I think it's the vision of witchcraft that we get in the modern world, which is very much post the witch trials and post, you know, extreme Christianity and persecution. We have this idea of the witch being an outsider's identity. And I think a lot of people are drawn to witchcraft because of that connection. When we look historically, that's not always the case. We see witches and magical practitioners of all kinds, cunning people, whatever, at kind of the centers of their community, holding really important central roles to the hierarchy. It's just that that was destabilized by, you know, persecution. And so I've been trying to think about my relationship to the word witch and the word and then the notion of like transgression inherent to the identity, this outsider quality to it. And whether or not that's a word that still suits me, whether or not it's a word I want to keep in circulation, and sort of just like analyzing that aspect of it. I feel like that is what draws a lot of people to the occult, and especially under the first Trump administration and post-COVID, a lot of people were, I think, at, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Identifying with that archetype. That's why witchcraft has seen, I think, the revival that it has in the last 10 years or so.
No, that makes sense to me. Well, and I think, you know, and maybe we talked about this before we started, but, you know, I think as things get noticeably worse, like politically or with climate crisis, or like people are looking for some way to, you know, protect themselves, fight back, you know, whatever. And mainstream religion doesn't offer a lot of that always.
No, it doesn't. Especially the meaning making within the context of our ecology, I think, is really important for a lot of people when we're seeing wide scale ecological collapse and destruction. Being put back in touch with, I feel corny saying this, but like the forgotten reality of humans as animals. And within this, like I was saying this earlier, like there is no world without wilderness. The right. human world is sort of an illusion, and that wilderness, that natural aspect, is always there. Mm-hmm. And I think people really are drawn to the occultism now because it puts them back in touch with that in a real visceral mm-hmm. way. And that, like, being able to step into a wider context, especially one that's real, you know, mm-hmm. that's material, shall I say, yeah. where I'm in a community of beings that are trees, that are minerals, that are plants, instead of under the dominion of Skyman I'll never meet, or, you know, any other kind of like monotheistic and popular religion. Mm-hmm. I think that the occult offers people something that's tangible.
Yeah,
in a lot of ways.
Well, and I think, you know, one of the things in that revival that I've really seen is this conversation around animism in a meaningful way. And, you know, listening to Indigenous voices like Robin Wall Kimmerer, and, you know, like, we aren't separate from the wilderness.
No.
Like, it's all the same thing. And your house is made out of things that came from what you think of as nature. And now you don't, because they've been produced by men. But it's the same thing, you know, like...
And the thing that I love about Robin Wall Kimmerer is that she's also a scientist and an academic. Mm-hmm. And it really, we don't have a lot of discussion about animism coming from people with that kind of credential and that kind of background. I think for the last 30 years or so, especially since like the 60s and 70s animist movements, there's been the idea that these currents are inherently anti-scientific, inherently anti reality. You know what I mean? In the same way that religion is kind of relegated to that mm-hmm. fantasy realm.
Yeah.
And to have scientists talking about like, no, we can actually measure plant intelligence. We can talk about these, like, it's not woo-woo to talk about nature as a living being, right?
Yeah.
One that we have to interface with and interact with in order to survive on this planet. It's something that we need to be in collaboration with, for lack mm-hmm. of a better word.
Yeah.
To talk about collaboration with the living beings of plants is now a thing that scientists are doing.
Yeah.
And that has really done a lot, I think, for the animist movement. There's another great researcher on that subject named Monica Gagliano, who's based out of Australia. She's a plant researcher who focuses on measuring how plants learn and how plants think. Like, how long is a plant's memory? That's the kind of questions that mm-hmm. she answers. And she ends up having to do a lot of work with the indigenous groups out there, the Aboriginal groups, who know a lot of this information about plant intelligence and about working with plant spirits or plants as entities, but know it from a mystical perspective, not a scientific perspective. She's ending up validating a lot of these Aboriginal ideas about plant spirits and plant intelligence with her research. Incredibly cool stuff. So very, very similar to Robin Wall Kimmerer, just on the other side of the world.
Yeah,
It's great to see a lot of that, you know, getting academic discussion.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I mean, it's, again, like, people are, you know, half jokingly talking about the end times. And I feel like on some level, we're finally kind of getting somewhere at the same time. It's a very weird, it's a very weird time all around. So,
yes. But I do think that the plants are returning to engagement with the natural world has been, if not like a healing and saving thing for a lot of people, then at least a balm on the wound of like watching the world rot in a philosophical sense, in a cultural sense, and in a very material real sense. Being a witch during the end times, it's a cool experience that I didn't think I'd be having.
Yeah, that was not on my 5-year plan.
No. Also, what is the role of the witch in the end times, right? I've been thinking about that a lot as I write about animism and as I like think about producing work on witchcraft in the end of the world is what is the thing that we can do now that is meaningful, that is revolutionary, that is at least assistive? And I think a lot of it is just like constantly taking a hammer to the illusions that we get from capitalism, the illusions that we get from patriarchy, the illusions that we get from, I think, just being in the Anthropocene, just the end of human culture. a lot of the illusions that we get from organized religion, or at least cultures that operate on the basis of organized religion. That's an important role that we take right now. And one of the ways that we can do that is bringing people back into authentic relationship with the natural world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, witchcraft and the occult, and I would maybe even couch this and say witchcraft even more based on my personal experience, has a relationship with the cyclical nature of birth and death. And what we are witnessing is a larger death. And yes. I think, you know, not to be twee about it, but witches are kind of doula-ing the end of the world in some ways.
That is another important role that death keepers can have right now. Yeah. Absolutely. If you have a more nuanced version of death than this society allows for, which is any amount of nuance whatsoever,
yeah.
Really just the fortitude to not avert your eyes from the problem once it becomes difficult, really.
Yeah.
If you have that within you, gotta be using that to help other people through it. We all are going through that like monumental, colossal grief, I think.
Yeah.
I think if people are not going through that right now, they're averting the eyes really early. Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, there is some hope in it, because if you do believe in the cyclical nature, then something comes out of this, right? And I mean, there is this, and maybe it's not us. I mean, that's its own kind of acceptance, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe it isn't humans. Maybe it's something else, you know, like, even my dad, who was not a witch or an animist in any way, was like, you know, the earth is always going to be here, whether we're on it or not. Well, until the sun explodes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's a long time.
Or at least a while longer.
Yeah. So it's, you know, the planet will be fine. It's just, have we made it an uninhabitable for us? So,
which is a bummer.
Yeah.
You know, in my research for this paper at BGS, I've been returning to this article I wrote in 2020 for Fiddler's Green, which was called Anti-Humanism and Witchcraft. And it kind of talks about what is magic and what is witchcraft with the human removed.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to practice witchcraft without the human being present? And what happens to our practice when we remove its inherent human centricity, when I no longer center my needs, my wants, but instead make it about relationship with the wider ecology of spirits that I'm a part of. And it was a cool article and a cool like thought process at the time. And I've come to the conclusion that I really define witchcraft more than any other like occult practice as a sorcery of the non-human, of it, like your work doesn't operate unless you're engaging with spirits, with plants, with animals, and with other beings that you acknowledge as beings and not just see as objects. When we look at magic in that way, we see it as something that is really, really helpful at this time period where the human is being forcibly decentered from the natural world, right? And so I think it's like that kind of perspective, and putting out work on that perspective is causing people to rethink what does it mean to be an occultist here at the ecological collapse of the world. Just dark little pessimistic thoughts that I'm having, really.
Yeah, it's funny because I mean, I do think it is dark and it is easy to be pessimistic, but weirdly, I don't know, maybe it's some form of radical acceptance but I'm oddly hopeful and I don't know why. Like, it's real strange and I haven't quite wrapped my head around it.
What are you hopeful for?
I think maybe it's like the denouement. I don't know. Maybe that's what I'm hoping. It's like, you know, what comes after? I think I am curious, like, what comes after what is coming? And I don't even know what that is. Like, you know, I think humans are, like a lot of species, incredibly adaptive. What happens? You know, like, I don't know. So... It's almost like the curiosity has caused hope. I don't know.
I like that. And at one point, we might realize that what's really not sustainable is like the five people who get to make decisions for all of us.
Yeah.
And how that's, you know, maybe we create fertilizer from them. I don't know. That would be super sustainable.
Very sustainable. Recycling, you know.
I want to compost Elon Musk so badly. If I got put in charge of that project, I would wake up every morning with a smile on my face.
Yeah.
Oh, man. There is a lot of, The other thing that I think is a part of it for me is the relinquishing of control. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm no longer.
And that may be part of it too. That's part of that hope too, I think. Like, this is not, I'm not moving these wheels.
No, I'm doing the best that I can to educate and radicalize everyone around me, to live my life in a way that is in accordance with my values, and to, you know, make the most positive impact that I can. But other than that, I have no control over who gets drilling rights. I have no control over who gets genocided. No one asked for my opinion. No one took my vote. You know what I mean? And beyond doing what we can in our immediate sphere, I've just sort of relinquished the hope of like being saved. And so what does my life mean and what does my work mean if no one is coming to save me or no one's coming to save all of us? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What does it mean if there's no future for us? How can this work still be valuable? And what does meaning making mean within that context? Yeah. It's not about the preservation of lineage or the preservation of knowledge and tradition. So for me, it's become about the creation of art and the radicalization of everyone around me. I don't know. And that's comforting for me, just sort of the immediacy. And with that comes an urgency to create, right?
Yeah.
If there's no future, I have to make the artwork now. I have to do the magic now. And that, I don't know, that's where I draw a lot of my, like, maybe hope's not the word, but positivity from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a dark place to get positivity from, yeah. But that's a witchcraft
Well,
thing.
I mean, you know, joy can exist in strange places. So it's all weird times, which seems glib, and I don't really mean it that way because it's true, but it's also like you said, there is this radical acceptance that no one's coming to save us.
But that's so inherent to the witch archetype as well. The idea of like, no one's coming to save me, hell, I might even be persecuted, so what am I gonna do? How am I gonna live my life? What is that gonna mean for me? Am I gonna like cough it up and die? Am I going to lie here and wait for them to come, wait for the earth to be destroyed around me? Or am I going to make this purposeful, even though it exists briefly and under difficult conditions? You know what I mean? I feel like that's so inherent to the witch archetype that we inherit in the modern world. And I think that it's one of the reasons that she, the witch archetype, in big air quotes, is so uniquely positioned to be helpful and meaningful right now. I think a lot of people are seeing that value too.
Yeah, no, I love that. Oh, it seems very weird to transition to what do you got coming up, Melissa? But it's kind of where
What's
we are
going on in your
the time.
Limited future.
Yeah. So what is on the horizon for you? Like I said, this will come out middle of February. So what's coming up for you?
Okay. Well, before they come to round me up and burn me at the stake, my plan. I there might be a new book coming out for me in this new year. We're in talks about it. We'll see what comes of that. I've been publishing a lot of new work on Patreon. I've been really hitting the ground running with my personal research this year. We've launched some new programs there, and we've expanded what we offer on Patreon in terms of community, in terms of class libraries. So there's a lot of that going on. The big thing for this spring is I'm partnering with the Morbid Anatomy Museum based here in New York. They're a great organization for promoting like interesting and obscure research. They've taken me on for two teaching opportunities. We're doing one class in late February on the history of flying ointments. We were talking about this using psychedelics as part of witchcraft. That's where a lot of that lore comes from. So we're going to talk about like the legend and the facts of using flying ointments historically. And then we're doing a three-part series on working the poison path. So exploring poisonous plants as allies in the magical art, not necessarily in an entheogenic aspect. So not like taking plants to get high all the time, but what does it mean to work with that which can kill us? Actually, super relevant to the conversation we were just having.
Exactly.
So that's what I have going on at Morbid Anatomy. And then other than that, I'm teaching a little bit, you know, popping up a few new classes every single month for my patrons. Sometimes that research gets to see social media. Sometimes it doesn't. But this year for me is really going to be focused on doing a lot of that important research, getting it out into the world, and lecturing at conferences, speaking at different schools, and refocusing back on the education and the books and stuff. So I might publish my book. I'll have these, you know, class opportunities coming up. That's what's big for me right now.
That sounds great. Awesome. So we did this last time. We did our little last question. And I feel like we've touched on like almost every single one of these, but we're going to give it a go and see what we get. So if you remember, I will roll a die. And depending on what I get, you'll get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money. I think we've hit on almost every one of these except maybe sex. So I'm going to roll a die and see what you get. You did get politics last time. So if you get that one, I'm going to roll again.
Reroll? Okay, yeah.
Cool. So one, death. So I'm going to ask a very specific question because we've been talking about it in a very large context. So, and this kind of harkens back to our previous conversation. It is almost your time to join the ancestors. What is your last meal?
Oh, you know, even though I put out a book on kitchen witchcraft, no one's ever asked me this question.
Really? That really surprises me.
No one's ever asked me what my favorite food in the world is. No one's ever, no. My last meal. This is going to sound like so Mediterranean. I don't know if we've talked about this. My family's Eastern European. We come from Croatia, which is like right next to Italy. No Americans know where it is. So I always describe
the location. I lived in Slovenia for a year. I know exactly where Croatia is.
But... So you know exactly where it is. Yeah. No other Americans have any sense. I tell them I'm from Croatia and they're like, is that next to Romania? I'm like, no. No, we share a border with it. But anyway. So that's where my family's from. That's where a lot of my personal like eating traditions come from. And when I think about like the last thing I want to eat, I actually am not thinking about like sumptuous comfort foods. I really want a dish of good quality olive oil with a little bit of nice balsamic in there and an entire roll of unbelievable bread. And I want to just go through olive oil and bread. Mm-hmm. That to me is like such a decadent meal. If we can finish it off with my favorite dessert in the world, and this is as a pastry chef, it's going to sound so weird, unsweetened whipped cream with like some berries, no sugar, just the, the sweetness and the fattiness of like the milk fat. That's what I would have my last meal on this earth. And I know it sounds like a peasant's meal from 1453, but like it really is the simple thing, you know what I mean?
No, it sounds delicious, actually.
Yeah, when I am dead, olive oil will be the thing that I miss most about being alive.
Yeah, I love it. And it's so funny because I think about like one of my favorite restaurants to go to here is this just an incredible Persian restaurant. And they always bring out like warm pita and a dish of olive oil and spices. And I always have to hold back because I've ordered food, but like I could just go eat that.
That's it. That's all I want. I don't know. I had no canned answer brand, but I immediately thought of just like a giant dish of like, like, you know, the olive oil that's dark green and cloudy
and almost grassy when you,
Yes. And I'm talking like I will eat the entire loaf of bread because I'm about to die. So there's no, you know, I'm not worried about tomorrow. I'm not worried about the carbs. I want to go to my grave with an entire belly full of like big loaf of bread and good olive oil.
That sounds amazing. Sounds amazing.
Great question. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm really surprised, like having written a cookbook that nobody asked you that, but.
I mean, they're more interested in the witchcraft. So they're like, which of these rituals do you do on a regular basis? And I'm like, none. I don't do witchcraft every day. I have life and books to write.
Well, I didn't even ask you. That is so important because I think people have this idea you've written a book and your life is just like this fairy tale of getting up and doing 20 rituals a day. And I'm like, nobody lives like that. If they do,
nobody lives like that. No one. Yeah. No.
We don't have temple priestesses anymore. We don't have that.
No, people ask me that a lot. They're like, what does your daily ritual routine look like? And I'm like, nothing. If my cat knocks over something on the altar, I put it back. I'm vigilant about that kind of stuff. You know, if throughout my day I need to make a petition or I need to, you know, like, it's as needed, just like anything else in my life. Yeah. Like, I other than brushing my teeth and combing my hair, what are my daily rituals? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's nothing in my life.
I would love to do that, but like, it's just not. We got to eat. We got to feed ourselves. Yeah. We got to have the money to do those things. You know, like, it's just not really possible.
Also, like, being a witch is a huge part of who I am, but it's not everything. I'm also an artist. Exactly. I'm also a writer. And my life would feel completely incomplete if I was just set up to do devotional magic and spellcraft constantly. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Plus it's exhausting.
It is exhausting. Oh God. Psychic work like that is incredibly exhausting. Very, very tiring, very laborious. I don't know. To me, my life is also more than just the witchcraft.
Yeah.
People forget that a lot about occultists.
Well, I think that is a good thought to leave people with. And thanks for coming back on. And I always enjoy our conversations.
So good. Yeah, I'll see you again after the third book.
Sounds like a plan. Witch Lit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shenekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram or Threads at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. And thank you for listening to and reading Witch Lit.